Gaza. They can see these fertile, relatively uncrowded territories while they live crowded into a ghetto half the size of New York City that the UN called unlivable for human beings before October 7th. And so, yes, if Gaza is unlivable because Israel and the United States have made it catastrophically unlivable, then people should be allowed to return to the places from which, not to expel Israeli Jews, but to live in equality alongside Israeli Jews, a principle that is considered unfathomable in Israel-Palestine, even though it's the principle that we supposedly believe in the United States.
So with those remarks, Peter, let's just get to your book. If you could just begin, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Explain why you wrote this book and to whom the book is addressed.
The book is addressed to my fellow Jews and trying to say that something has gone catastrophically wrong in our community when an Israeli government that claims to speak for the Jewish people and American Jewish leaders can watch a Jewish state with American weapons destroy most of the buildings, most of the hospitals, most of the schools, most of the agriculture, leave an unprecedented number of child amputees in Gaza, and then justify this with the flimsiest of possible justifications, as I go through in my book. That we have, Jewish tradition, as I understand it, believes in the infinite dignity of every human being. That is, we say every life is a universe. How is it that people who, that our tradition, which speaks that way, and yet our leadership today acts in such a way that is radically contrary to that principle?
Well, one of the things that you say is early on in the book, you talk about the secularization of Judaism, which in certain instances, as you say, has led to a kind of moral evasion. Of course, one should say that that's not only true of Judaism, but arguably of other Abrahamic faiths as well. You say, quote, in the absence of a belief in divine reward and punishment, we no longer wrestle in the same way with what our sacred texts say about Jewish ethical responsibility. If you could elaborate on that.
I think what's happened in Jewish communities in the U.S. around the world is that a religion, a vast and religion that speaks in many, many different voices, but emphasizes the dignity of all human beings, has been swallowed by ethno-nationalism. In many Jewish communities around in the United States today, you get in more trouble for challenging the legitimacy of the state of Israel than for questioning the authority of the Torah, right? The social penalties for being a critic of Israel are much greater than the social penalties for violating Shabbat or keeping kosher, which are foundational principles in Jewish faith. I think something similar in some ways is happening among many white Christians. In the era of Donald Trump, these people seem to think that if you don't have an American passport, you are worthless. It's as if that Christianity's universal message has been swallowed by the ethno-nationalism of America First. And in a way, when you see Jewish discourse about Israel, you see something similar. The state is sacred, and what our tradition says about human beings is ultimately devalued.
You write in your book, Peter, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, about the anguish of Palestinians. You say, this book is about the story Jews tell ourselves to block out the screams. So go back in history and talk to us about what Jews understand, Israelis understand, and what the standard education is and how you re-educated yourself. For example, right now, what's being talked about is this forcing out of the Palestinian population. It's not the first time. It's not even the second time. Talk about the exoduses.
Right. This is in Israel's political DNA. Israel was created with an act of mass expulsion of Palestinians. That's why those people are in Gaza in the first place. There was another act of mass expulsion in 1967, and there have been smaller expulsions since then, ongoing. Right? And so this is something that is inherent in the notion. If the notion of your state is that the state has to have a large Jewish majority, that Jews have to rule, then Palestinians constitute a demographic problem, right? And so it's not really surprising at all that people on the Israeli right want to solve that demographic problem by getting rid of Palestinians. That's how Israel was created in the first place.
Explain what happened then in 1948. Explain what happened to the Palestinian villages.
they were completely demolished. What happened was that David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, said, this cannot be a truly Jewish state unless it has a roughly 80% Jewish majority, which was actually the state that Israel would have been given under the UN was far, far less than that. So you had to carry out mass ethnic cleansing. In Jewish communities, people tend to say this only began when the Arab countries invaded in May 1948. It's not true. Haifa and Jaffa, for instance, the largest Palestinian populations, were ethnically cleansed before May 1948 because it was impossible to create a Jewish state. There were simply too many Palestinians there, so you had to clear them off in order to create a large Jewish majority where Jews controlled the land. That's how Israel was created, and it's the refusal in Israel and in organized American Jewish communities and in Washington to honestly discuss that history that brings us to this point where we have an American president who wants to replay that history.
And so if you could say, Peter, you speak at some length in the book about the responses to October 7th in the Jewish communities, and in the U.S., I would say, in some ways generally, the kinds of analogies that were drawn to October 7th, the images that were invoked by October 7th. And you are critical of some of those images, if you could elaborate on what the analogies are and what you think the better analogy, which you enumerate in the book, the better analogies are for what happened on October 7th.
Right. So what happened on October 7th was horrifying. It was really, for me, one of the worst days of my life. And I fundamentally oppose any targeting of civilians, no matter what the circumstances are. But if one wants to prevent future October 7th and make both Israeli Jews and Palestinians safer, you have to understand the conditions that existed in Gaza on October 6th, not to justify, but to understand. And instead, what happened in the Jewish discourse was this was immediately called a pogrom. It was called the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. The implication was that this is the reenactment of the murderous anti-Semitism in Europe. But it's fundamentally wrong, because that anti-Semitism took place in a case in which Jews were legal inferiors. You can't understand pogroms or the Holocaust without understanding the role of Jews as a subjugated people. But in Israel-Palestine, it's Palestinians who are a subjugated people, who live without basic rights, who are being oppressed. October 7th was an inhumane response to that oppression. And if you want to understand it, one should think about other inhumane responses to oppression. Think about in our own country, when Native Americans were forced off their land into smaller and smaller ghettos. There were many times in the 19th century where Native Americans broke out of those reservations and killed men, women, and children in pitiless attacks, right? But you had to understand the context of what was happening then to understand that violence. Instead, what we see, and this is exactly what happened with Native Americans, is they're simply described as barbarians. And when you describe them as barbarians and savages, you justify even more catastrophic violence against them.
Well, and you say, and this was a very interesting interpretation that you gave afterwards, when you explained the correct way to understand this horrific violence of October 7th, you say that pondering these analogies is alien and uncomfortable, the analogy that you just gave, for example, of Native Americans. They alter the script that explains who we are. And then you point out that earlier generations of Zionists made such comparisons and were, quote, less invested in Jewish innocence. So explain why that is. One would instinctively think the reverse, right? That it was in early Zionism that there was a greater investment in Jewish innocence and arguably a greater case for it.
Right. It's really remarkable now, right? Because today, if you were to call Israel a colonial enterprise, right, you would probably be kicked out of your synagogue. You would be censured by the American Congress, right? You could be penalized at some kind of university. But if you go back and read early Zionist writers, Theodore Herzl, the most important founder of political Zionism, Vladimir Jabotinsky, the founder of revisionist Zionism, which is Benjamin Netanyahu's own tradition, they use this term frequently and positively to describe what they're doing. Herzl writes to Cecil Rhodes, the arch-imperialist of Southern Africa and says, we're involved in a common enterprise here, right? Because for them, colonialism meant bringing progress and modernity to a backward part of the world and taking control over it from the populations that were there because a population from a more advanced civilization could use the territory better, right? That's the real history of Zionism's own. You don't have to read Palestinians. You just have to read early Zionist writers because there was an honesty there that is not possible today because now we live in an age where colonialism is a dirty word. It wasn't a dirty word in the early 20th century.
Peter Beinart, how does growing up in South Africa inform your view?
I spent a fair amount of my childhood in a place where white South Africans, including members of my own family, were absolutely convinced that if there was legal equality, if black people got the vote and could form a black government, that their lives would be in mortal danger. It was considered just obvious. And the reason I think this is important is that it is so common in American Jewish and American discourse to assume that if the Palestinians got equality, Jews could never live in Israel and Palestine safely. And the point I try to make in my book is that white South Africans believe the same thing. Protestants in Northern Ireland believe the same thing. Ian Paisley, the Protestant leader, on the eve of the Good Friday Agreement, which gave Catholics political equality, called it prelude to genocide. So many white Southerners and white Americans in general believe that without slavery and segregation, white people would become the slaves, would become the oppressed class. It's not true. It wasn't true. In fact, what we find is that when you give people a voice in government, when they can be represented, that violence goes down because people have a nonviolent path for government to listen to them. That, it seems to me, is the lesson that Jews should try to learn from those experiences.
I mean, just to go back to a point that you made earlier, Peter, about the kind of injunction against saying something against Israel, critical of Israel, versus saying something against Judaism. You also point out in your, or being a Jew, you point out in the book that in Israel itself, there's no religious requirement for election to the Knesset. This is you writing. Of the 14 Israeli PMs, prime ministers, only one, Naftali Bennett, has observed Jewish law. But there is a Zionist requirement. Political parties cannot oppose, quote, the existence of the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. So if you could talk about what the implications of that are for the potential for a transformation into the kind of context that you've described post-apartheid South Africa.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to make is that both in Israel and the United States, in different ways, the Jewish community is structured to basically make the existence of a Jewish state, a state that privileges Jews over Palestinians, sacred, right? So in Israel, it doesn't matter whether you observe Jewish law. You can be the prime minister, but you can't run for Knesset under Israeli law unless you accept the principle of a state in which Jews rule. In the United States, if you look at Hillel, the organization that works on college campuses, they say very openly to students, we don't care whether you observe any Jewish practice at all, but if you don't support the existence of Israel as a Jewish state, then essentially you're not welcome here, right? To me, this is essentially what happens when you elevate ethno-nationalism, a Jewish state over Judaism itself.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, you in the book, you cite Hannah Arendt, who was already warning of the dangers of Jewish nationalism, saying, quote, the greatness of this people, the Jewish people, was once that it believed in God, and now this people believes only in itself.
Yes. And in fact, our own tradition also speaks in this way, right? One of the gravest sins in Judaism is idolatry. Idolatry is the worship of something human made. A state is human made, right? Mm-hmm. In Jewish tradition, as I understand it, you start with the sanctity and the dignity of the individual. And that is paramount. And then a state must be evaluated. Its legitimacy is dependent on how it treats the individual. So again and again, we are required to say that we believe Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. No. The children of Gaza have a right to exist. They have a right to live. Their lives are of infinite value. And the question you ask about the structure, the political system of any state is that state guaranteeing that right to life and that right to flourish? And if it's not, if it's failing radically, if it's destroying those lives, then you have to think about reconstituting the state in a more ethical way.
Peter Beinart, leading Jewish organizations like the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, the AJC, would never question the findings of international legal organizations like the International Court of Justice or the ICC when it comes to concluding genocide took place in Bosnia, took place in Rwanda. Talk about the view of what's happening today. And I want to fold into that your quoting of the leading Jewish theologian, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who said, "Whenever I open the prayer book, I see before me the images of children burning with napalm."
Right. You know, Heschel is a hero among many American Jews because he brought the message of the prophets to America. When he marched in Selma and when he marched against the Vietnam War, he said, I believe in a tradition that will speak truth to power in the name of the protection of all life. And Heschel knew nothing of Vietnam. This man grew up as a Hasid in Poland. He had no connection to those people. And yet he could see their infinite dignity, and he challenged the organized American Jewish community and the American government to stop destroying them. And so what I have asked myself again and again and again, and I'm an observant Jew since October 7th, where is our religious and moral leadership today of rabbis who would get up and say, I can't pray because I am haunted by the sights of the child amputees in Gaza, of the people who are marching, whose homes have been destroyed, who are living in tents, whose tents are now flooded, who can't get hospital care, whose lives are being utterly ravaged. And yet I just see a community that goes about its business and indeed penalizes people who have the audacity to stand in the footsteps of Heschel and raise these moral concerns.
Well, talk about that, Peter. I mean, what has happened? What have you seen happen here in the community? Because you've also said, even as there has been this, very difficult to say anything critical of Israel, that there is a massive generational shift that's occurring, that younger people are much more critical. They are much more, oriented towards the, justice for Palestine. And what effect do you think that's having on the conversation?
Yes, because there has been a deep contradiction at the heart of American Jewish life. We have told our children that our safety and our values lead us to believe in equality under the law, never again for anyone. And also that we have a tradition of fierce and open debate, which we're very proud of. And then we say to those children, except for on the subject of Israel, which, by the way, is the most important subject, right? And children are good at noting the hypocrisy of their parents, right? And challenging the hypocrisy of their parents. And so many of these children, I've met so many of them who say, you are violating the very principles in which I was taught to believe about what it means to be a Jew, and I'm going to live those principles, even if it brings me into conflict with you, even if it brings me into conflict with our community.
And your response to the very serious crackdown on the pro-Palestinian, you could say pro-justice protests across the country, the encampments, both on the students, you're a professor yourself at CUNY Journalism School, the Newmark School of Journalism, and on professors, and ultimately President Trump saying he's going to deport the international students, I think he calls them alien students, who are, quote, Hamas sympathizers, meaning who engaged in pro-Palestinian protest.
Right. You know, Amy, you know this as well as I do. We have a tradition of learning that is sacred in our tradition, which is part of the reason that American Jews have had a particular affinity for these universities. So many American Jewish families have raised ourselves up through these universities and this tradition, and these universities are a core of American liberal democracy. And yet, in order to protect Israel from the criticism that is happening at these universities, because these universities have a lot of young progressive people, including a lot of young progressive Jews, the organized American Jewish community is essentially willing to get in bed with the Trump administration as it tries to crush academic freedom and freedom of speech at America's universities. And it won't stop on the question of Israel and Palestine. We know very well that the restrictions on free speech, that this is going to be a model and a template for when students want to protest about abortion rights and climate change and racial justice, right? And we're crushing these institutions, which American Jews claim to believe in so much, in order to try to protect them from criticism of Israel.
Peter Beinart, we want to thank you for being with us, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. His new book is just out, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Up next, amidst the protests against President Trump and Elon Musk's attempts to dismantle the federal government, we'll look at Trump's attacks on the Department of Education, the dismantling of the Department of Education. Stay with us. Sullivan Baines, Do You Know Black History? This is Democracy Now! In the midst of Black History Month. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As President Trump and Elon Musk attempt to dismantle the federal government, we end today's show with Trump's plans to issue an executive order to abolish the Department of Education, even though the agency can only be shut down through an act of Congress. The Department of Education was established by President Jimmy Carter in 1979 to oversee public school funding, administer student loans, and run programs to help low-income students. On Friday, dozens of longtime Education Department staffers who'd attended a diversity training course during the first Trump administration were put on paid leave. Trump has accused the agency of, quote, indoctrinating young people with inappropriate racial, sexual, and political material. The confirmation hearing has yet to be scheduled for Trump's education secretary nominee, billionaire pro-wrestling magnate and Republican mega-donor Linda McMahon. On Capitol Hill Tuesday, education groups joined with labor unions as the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools to protest against Trump's education department plans, and students have held protests and walkouts nationwide over Trump and to oppose attacks on mixed immigration status families.
Meanwhile, as the Department of Defense has canceled many so-called identity months, some wonder if Black History Month will continue to be taught in schools. For more, we're joined by Jesse Hagopian, longtime educator, high school teacher in Seattle, Washington. He has a new book. It's titled Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. Jesse's on the leadership team of the Zinn Education Project, which draws on historian Howard Zinn's seminal book, A People's History of the United States. He also serves on the National Steering Committee of Black Lives Matter at School. His recent article for The Nation, The Far Right's Plan to Force Teachers to Lie About Race. Jesse Hagopian, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you start off by talking about the significance of Trump very openly talking about the dismantling of the Department of Education. What would that mean?
Good morning. Hello, Amy and Nermeen. Happy Black History Month and happy Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action. Thanks for having me back on the show. You know, Trump's array of executive orders have been so blatantly unlawful that I would say he should enroll in a high school American government class to learn the basics of the Constitution, except I don't know a teacher that would allow him in their classroom, given his record of boasting about sexual assault. And his plan to abolish the Department of Education isn't about local control, as he claims. We know that because he's issued so many federal edicts about what kids are allowed to learn. But let's call this what it is, an extremist authoritarian power grab to dismantle public education and enforce ideological conformity. And we know that only Congress has the legal authority to completely end the Department of Education, but he's already begun dismantling it. He doesn't have to fully abolish it in order to stop it from functioning, right? He can appoint a secretary who dismantles protections from the inside, like he's planning to do with Linda McMahon, and he can gut its funding and staff, as you pointed out. Already, he has ended the department's tracking of book bans, right? Effectively giving states a green light to erase history. The American Library Association has documented over 4,200 book titles that were banned in 2023 and over 1,000 more last year, right? And so a staggering like 60% of these books are children's books featuring characters of color. They've been banning books like the Ruby Bridges story, Miles, the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel about the Holocaust, books about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And this isn't about protecting children. We know that dismantling the Department of Education is really about imposing what Professor Henry Giroux has called the violence of organized forgetting, right? Erasing history and replacing knowledge with state-based propaganda. And I'll just say, if the order is successful, if he's able to either gut or completely abolish the Department of Education, it would end some $18 billion in Title I funding, which provides crucial support to high-poverty schools like many that I've taught in throughout the country. I began teaching in Washington, D.C., and I would pass the White House on my way to school in Anacostia in one of the most impoverished neighborhoods. And my Title I school had a hole in the ceiling of my classroom, and it would just rain in. The rain destroyed the first project I ever assigned as a teacher before the kids could even present it. And that's why the schools desperately need this funding that he is getting ready to gut, as well as students with accommodations, IEP plans. Special education funding is crucial, some $15 billion from the Department of Education goes to that. This isn't education reform plan. This is really educational arson that he's proposed.
And explain, Jesse, who is his nominee, Linda McMahon?
I mean, it is breathtaking. She fits the profile of so many of his appointees in that she is completely unqualified, very little background in education. She was a CEO for WWE Wrestling, and like many of his nominees, is also under investigation for allowing sexual assault to run rampant in her organization. She would be a disaster for the public schools in this country. We need someone with a real vision for what the public schools can be and for keeping our children safe, not another privatizer.
Jesse Hagopian, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to do part two of this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Jesse is a high school teacher in Seattle, Washington. His new book is called Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. And before we end this segment, do you think your book, Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education, will be allowed to be taught in the public schools of the United States?
Well, with the rampant book banning, I'm worried about that. But I hope that educators take a look at it, because this is really a story about how they're trying to revive the worst of the McCarthy era, the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare, to attack teachers who teach the truth about U.S. history, about Black history, about Indigenous history, about trans history and LGBTQ plus history, and we need these lessons desperately.
And we're going to talk about them in part two of this discussion. Jesse Hagopian rhymes with utopian. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca. Find us on social media and please support our vital work through our website.